We know that cities around the world are deeply flawed. More than half of all humans, about 3.2 billion of us, live in urban areas. An estimated 3/4 of all city dwellers inhabit slums, with no municipal services, such as clean water or sewers. In a surprising development, some American cities are now in trouble. As the subprime mortgage crisis teams up, with good-paying jobs taking off overseas, today's speaker, Clive Doucette, warns of a new phenomenon in North America, urban meltdown. Doucette is not talking about cities collapsing, but the disappearance of all the culture and services that make them livable. Some major American sites, he says, are becoming refugee cities. People flee the areas of foreclosed, boarded up, and vandalized homes. Over 1,000 such homes have been torn down in Cleveland, which is suing the banks. As cities become less safe and people leave for cities of refuge, that weakens the tax base, closes some vital services, and leads to a further urban meltdown. Clive Doucette has a master's degree in urban anthropology. He's a longtime resident of the city of Ottawa, the capital of Canada. Doucette worked advising various governments on urban affairs for many years before deciding to run for office himself. He has been a municipal councillor for the past 10 years in the Ottawa area. His priorities have been defending local communities and getting more mass transit. Meanwhile, Doucette has published a dozen books, many of them dealing with his roots in rural Cape Breton, the Celtic-like island on Canada's east coast. His most popular work is Notes from Exile, but he has also published 4 books of poetry and several plays. His book, Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual, was launched in the spring of 2007, published by New Society Publishers. There is a website for the book at www.urban-meltdown.com and for Clive personally at clivedoucette.com. Doucette is spelled D-O-U-C-E-T. Our speech today was given at the Vancouver Public Library on January 24, 2008. It was arranged by the Necessary Voices Society. In addition to explaining the new reality of urban meltdown, Doucette explains one root cause, which surprisingly is family values. Has the ancient model of the family been a retrenchment from real civic values? This is a speech that is easy to underestimate. In fact, from his long experience in urban affairs, Doucette puts his finger on an ailment that threatens cities everywhere. Here is Clive Doucette.
I thought I would begin my talk with just one of the poems. Each chapter of my book begins with a poem. And I think this poem, I think, will explain a bit why I've devoted my life to trying to make the world a little bit more sustainable. If you came from the stars, across aeons of dark and cold, upon a planet that was not cold, that did not burn, that sparkled in a great and glorious disk of sea blue and white mist, that was bright like a great jewel, you might be forgiven if for a moment you'd thought you'd found heaven. I've been sort of working for heaven, I think, most of my life. I started in Toronto with the Spadina Expressway. I happened when I was a young man of 18 years old, I was studying archaeology and I lived on a street called Spadina. And it became the center of the greatest, I guess, urban struggle against an expressway that we've seen in North America. It was set to go from the 401 right down to the waterfront. At the beginning, there were, I think, 2 young women with young children who backed onto the Spadina Expressway decided they didn't want an expressway in their kids' backyard and began the movement. And in the end, it attracted Jane Jacobs, who had moved into the neighborhood, students like myself, and almost every residents' associations in the entire city. And it did get stopped. But one of the things about the Spadina Expressway that I never realized at the time, I thought it was because I sold buttons on Bloor Street. That's why we stopped it. And I realize now that it really had nothing to do with me at all. It had to do with the Spadina Expressway was set to go through North Toronto and the University of Toronto, 2 of the most expensive and desired neighborhoods in the country. And one of the things that doesn't happen is you don't put expressways through rich people's neighborhoods, ever. and property rights, in this case, triumphed over vehicle rights. In 2007, the reasons not to build more roads are stronger than they were in 1970. And with the exception of Vancouver, which is the absolute exception across the entire nation, it's the only city in the country where actually car ownership has stabilized and slightly declined. So you are living in a world which the rest of us aren't. So I congratulate you and wish we were in the same world. But when you wonder why, I wondered why it was that all the books that had been written, and Jane Jacobs wrote a fabulous book called The Death and Life of Great American Cities, which was widely still used in planning schools all across North America. William H. White, before her, wrote something called The Lost Landscape, which was about the destruction of the Pennsylvania countryside. We've had knowledge about the destructive effect of expressways for more than 50 years. And you know what? They won a lot of awards. They made people careers. People stood up in front of audiences and made speeches about them, and they've meant zero. I can say with confidence that 40 years of activism against expressways has not stopped them one little whit. The suburbs of Ottawa, you see these pictures of Ottawa, you'll see pictures of the old streetcar wards. Looks delightful, right? Well, everything that's been built in Ottawa since the destruction of the streetcar system in 1960 has been mall sprawl. And it's gotten bigger with every passing year. We now have things called power centers, which are so big you can land a B-54 in them. And the stores are like really warehouses, and people get in a car to drive from one end to the other. So what's happening is we're burning millennia of carbon energy storage every day. Every day we burn millennia of that carbon. And what that's doing, for anyone who's paying attention, and I'm sure all of you in this room are, is we're heating the planet in a way that's never been seen before in human history. And people are starting to think now there's never been this fast a change ever. The planet has gone up and down, but never this quickly. And I thought to myself, well, is there any place that isn't going like this? And actually, there was a place, and I discovered it last winter, and it's a place called Havana. I went to Havana because I was exhausted, and I booked into a big hotel in downtown and didn't move for 5 days. But I actually walked around the city a little bit, and what you see in Havana is something you don't see anywhere else in the planet. It's the most sustainable city in the world, as far as I know. And why is it so sustainable? Well, it's so sustainable not because they've chosen to be sustainable, but because when the Soviet Union melted down, the cozy arrangement the Cubans had with the Soviets collapsed. They could no longer sell their principal product, which was sugar, at elevated prices, and they could no longer get oil. And they had the American blockade surrounding the island, which is the most effective blockade you'll ever see. I sat on my loggia and I watched the container ships go along on the horizon towards Miami, and it looked like there was sort of a marine train. Everyone was separated by a few thousand meters, and one after another going by. Not in the week I was there, one ship came into Havana, and it was half loaded. And Havana is a city the size of Montreal, 2.5 million people. So what did they do to survive this? Because they had very little energy. What they did is they had to convert their monocultures and their pesticide-driven farms to what we call organic. They had to develop urban gardens, and they closed down most of their high rises, and only thing you could walk up, if you couldn't walk up to it, you didn't live in it. They decentralized their universities, and it's a very restrained life they live there. Don't kid yourself. I've never seen so little in stores. There's more in one big box supermarket in Ottawa than I think there is in the whole of Havana. But they still have a city that functions. They still have electricity. People still have enough food to eat, although the range isn't very big. And they still have medicine, and they still have education and a civil life. So we're not being forced to make these changes the way Havana was, the way Cuba was. And Cuba wouldn't have made it if they hadn't been. So where is the impetus for change coming in around us? Well, the answer is there isn't much. There isn't much. The announcement of Mr. Campbell is unusual and wonderful, but it's not typical of what happens across this country of ours. And if we're going to create a world that's going to endure a few more centuries, we have to find a way to move towards the kind of low energy imprint that Havana is. And the good news is, too, we have the resources now. We don't have to go into a dive the way they did. They went into a terrible dive where people actually starved to death. That has to happen. We've got the resources to take a nice gradual drop into where we're going to want to go. But we're not doing it. So how do we, why don't we do it? Well, I think it's got something to do with something called family values. Family values is a brand new thought for me. It came to me in the last election, provincial election in Ontario. And I was sitting in my community, much as you are here today, and I was listening to the new generation. Everyone was between 30 and 40, which was kind of wonderful, presenting themselves for the assembly in Toronto. And the speeches were all quite good, but the one that stuck in my mind was from a young woman who represented the Conservative Party. And she began by explaining her father was a policeman and her mother was a nurse, and that she had grown up with the right values. And she told me that these values had imbued her with the spirit to present her for public office. And then she talked about the government that was in place now and why it was essential to defeat them. Because if you went to the mall and you bought a product and it wasn't what you asked for, or it was inferior, you'd take it back, right? Well, this government had not delivered what they wanted, so we should send them back. And her speech had two basic points. It began with family values, and it ended with getting your money's worth from government, just as if government was a product you bought at the mall. In her mind, public services were no different than any other consumer product that you bought at Home Depot or Walmart or wherever. In the family values model, elected officials are the same as big box store managers. The politician is expected to deliver exactly what is advertised and, of course, for the lowest tax possible. If government fails to do this, you get rid of them. It was the simplicity and rawness of her message, delivered with youthful zest, that finally pried my eyes open to realizing that her vision of the world was not unique to her. It was actually shared by millions and millions of other people. And I suddenly made this connection between this young woman and the young man who presented against me in the last city election. He represented the Liberal Party. And every speech, he began with references to his family and the values he was imbued with, and then he moved on slightly differently, but the same basic message as the young woman. Mr. Harper is a family values kind of guy. He keeps his promises simple, and he delivers on them. He promises more tough laws on crime, lower prices, taxes, extension of the Canadian military service in Afghanistan, no harming of the carbon economy from a reduction in greenhouse gases, new armed border guards, getting rid of the gun registry, more arms in the north to protect Canadian sovereignty there. The irony is that the Arctic he's keen on protecting is disappearing because of the carbon first policies that he's promoting in the south. He doesn't seem to connect the two. But no one will be able to accuse Mr. Harper of not doing what he said he was going to do. There's no false advertising here. Good on him. The young woman who I heard about getting a good deal from government and lower taxes would have been elected easily in one of the mall wards in Ottawa. She was confident, good speaker. She came a distant third. The question is why? Just as I had been blind to the power of family values, she was blind to the values of streetcars and streetcar values. She did not understand her family values did not resonate in an old streetcar ward. I heard people muttering after she spoke, but we're not voting for her parents. And what is she going to do? What's her platform? The values of an old streetcar ward are different, but that doesn't mean people are not religious or don't have spiritual connections. In my ward, there are many churches, many faiths, and many languages. In just one of the neighborhoods I represent, you can find a Portuguese church, Latvian, French, English, Spanish, Baptist, United, Lutheran, Roman Catholic. The Spanish and the French congregations share the same church and the same priest. He speaks both languages very well. But they are different. The churches themselves are physically different from the big box churches that you would find in a mall ward. All of the churches in my ward are within walking distance of each other. They blend into the streetscape. You could pass many of them and scarcely notice the building had a spire. They do not offer a wide range of social services. They have a church basement for meals, bazaars, and children's plays, and a worship hall above. This is the old landscape of a streetcar ward. The parishioners have families, spiritual concerns, and values, but they do not. They're not the same as the family values of the big box churches and the big box sprawl. In creating, and this is, I think, another new thought for me, in creating a new type of urban landscape organized around the single occupant vehicle, this landscape has in turn shaped the values of the people who live there. The churches are physically similar to the big box stores. Their most distinguishing feature is the parking lot. As the big box mall provides one-stop shopping, the big box church provides one-stop spiritual and compassionate shopping. The people have family values. They are inclusive, but are inclusive within the paradigm of being a member of the church, not within the paradigm of the civic culture of the street the church lives on. And this is crucial. The family values of a mall ward inspire people to vote for George Bush, Stephen Harper, and the mayor of my city. Tempted to say something here, but I won't. They prefer strong father figures to lead them politically and strong preachers to lead them spiritually. They believe in tax cuts and small government is better government as an article of faith, not as a result of the evidence. The latest report I've seen that confirms the tax cuts advantage the top 5% of the population was published by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives, which explains in simple, easy-to-grasp language that in spite of all the tax cuts, for most people, the modal population, life costs them more and they're earning less real dollars than they did 20 years ago. Doesn't matter. This knowledge doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because tax cuts are about family values. Families should take care of their own children. They don't see why government should mess around with things like daycare. It's a question of values, not knowledge. And they elect folks who speak the family language, family value language. But it would be more accurate to call them big box values, because that's the kind of world where these values are supported. The communities of the old streetcar wards are much more intimate. They are built for people first, not for cars. And they need and want governments who will care about the community as a community. They understand that things like daycare are a good community value as well as a good individual value. The folks who go to the churches in my ward do not vote for Mr. Harper, and they wouldn't vote for Mr. Bush if they were American. They understand instinctively that the church should be separate from the state. They don't want public funding for faith-based schools. They want compassionate government that will create and support public health care. They understand that wider roads don't make communities more livable. They make them dirtier, noisier, and poorer. This happens not because the spiritual values of people in the streetcar wards are much different from the mall wards. At the end of the day, most people pray in the same way, no matter what kind of church or mosque they happen to be in. It's because they live in these different landscapes. We can judge the power of our values by the sacrifices that people are willing to sustain them. People are willing to sacrifice their own health, their children's health, and the health of the planet before they will reduce the use of the automobile or elect politicians who will stop building roads and start building communities. And if you think I'm exaggerating, last year, SUV sales were up 19%, econo cars were down 9%. That's the world we live in. The old streetcar neighborhoods are different. Even though the streetcars are long gone, the old communities still function, much as if they were still rumbling down every main street. People walk, bicycle, take buses and cars. Parking lots are not the dominant feature of the landscape. The human being is. Stores are small. They front in the street. Merchants live or die based on walking traffic. Houses are crowded up to the street and sit on narrow lots. Often there is no driveway at all, or at best a shared one. It is not a happy place to be a car. There's just not enough room to store them at work, at home, or in the commercial areas. The old streetcar wards are now leftover places. It is in these old neighborhoods that the battle for inclusive public services continues to sputter, where the idea of a two-tier world continues to be most strongly resisted. But it is a trailing argument left over from another century and another age when we built cities differently. And I think it's important to face this. You know, I'm not belaboring it casually. It's important to understand this, that the kind of pressures we get for the kind of governments we got come from a real place and for real reasons. But unfortunately, as the mayor of Bogota has said, you can build a city for cars or you can build it for people. You can't do both. The irony is, the family values voters of the mall districts look back nostalgically to the 1950s on politicians like Eisenhower and Truman, and they are looking back on the world where the values were supported and created in streetcar neighborhoods and streetcar cities. In the family values consumer vision of society, there are fair trade products for the richer, child labor products for the poorer, organic food for the richer, pesticide-fed food for the poorer, charter schools for the richer, public schools for the poorer, home child care for the richer, make-do care for the poorer, private health care for the richer, welfare, public care for the poor, and so on, until the city, the nation, and the planet are divided up into a first tier and a second tier services, until citizens no longer live in nations where basic rights and services that apply to all have been abandoned in favor of public-private supply store. Let's call it GovMart, where each citizen is free to choose his mix of public-private products based on their ability to pay user charges. This is a recipe for creating unsustainable cities. This is New Orleans, absolutely. This is Buffalo. This is Detroit. This is Cleveland. This is the recipe for refugee cities. Because at the end of the day, cities have to work for all their residents, not just some of them. Nations are so large they can get along for a very long time with substantial territories that suffer terribly from poverty, suicide, despair. But cities have much smaller tolerances, simply because everyone lives so much closer to each other. Thus, the rot spreads much faster. The good news is, if you can get it right, the productive and successful also spread much faster. Look around the city at the planet, at cities, and you can see the human equivalent of shrinking ice surfaces. Urban habitats are more populous and popular than ever, but they're becoming ever more fragile. Believe you me, the Vancouvers of the world are the exceptions. You're living in quite a delightful and exceptional place. Cities that used to be secure destinations for refugees from economic and civil conflicts are becoming themselves sources of refugees. What used to be the exception, a city that no longer can support its population, that generates refugees rather than offers refuge, is becoming more common. The most dramatic North American example is New Orleans, but there are many others. Refugee cities all share the same basic characteristics. Entire neighborhoods become vandalized shells. Public infrastructure is battered, broken, and unreliable. This means schools, libraries, train stations, parks, public places are not places you would want to frequent unless you had no other choice. In refugee cities, both petty and violent crime become a way of life. In cities like Detroit, Cleveland, Buffalo, Mogadishu, Nairobi, Murmansk, you're seeing this sort of phenomena. The predictions are over the next 50 years, the Russian population will diminish from 150 million to 90. And it's also clear climate change-driven disasters lurk around the corners for Sunbelt cities like Atlanta and Phoenix, where water supplies are down to, I think in Atlanta, it's 90 days. The lake they're drawing water from is disappearing. In Detroit, the population declines by about 1,000 people every month. And like any other refugee city, it is in the anomalous position of not having enough city services and too many. It has more neighborhoods, roads, and public services than it needs, and the ones that continue to be occupied don't have enough services. Fortunately, Canada doesn't have any refugee cities. Canada is in the happy position of being populated by refuge cities, cities that our people are fleeing towards and in many cases dying to get to. A refuge city is the inverse of a refugee city. It is a place where people want to move to. In the United States, cities like Seattle, New York, Portland, Boulder, Colorado. In refuge cities, municipal services remain intact, efficient, and universal. Schools are repaired, safe, pleasant, and well-staffed. Sidewalks are repaired and walkable. Concert halls, theaters, and streets are well-patronized at any time of the day or night. In a refuge city, public transit is something you complain about but aren't afraid to use. Green parks are green and popular, not desolate and dirty. Neighborhoods are self-organized and run by confident, cranky residents who think they run the city, not the jackass who got elected. The refuge city employment base is diverse and resistant to the global bullying of give me a tax break or we'll leave town. In refuge cities, police rely on news of crime in other cities to keep their budgets from being reduced. Quebec City, for example, had one murder in 2006. Crime in the city of Ottawa has steadily declined year over year, and what murders there are sad products of domestic chagrin or the mentally ill. If Canada is a refuge nation, stocked with refuge cities that folks from refugee cities are anxious to get to, what's the problem? It's a comforting thought to think Canadian cities can continue to prosper without worrying much about the global phenomena, such as climate change and increase in refugee cities. But times can change remarkably quickly. Australia, like Canada, has long thought of itself as an oasis, well-stocked with comfortable refuge cities. 7 years of drought have finally driven the message home in Australia that climate change can threaten even places comfortable as Sydney, Australia. Water rationing is now in place in cities, and large areas of formerly prosperous agricultural area are being abandoned. It's taken 7 years. Unfortunately, the significance of grave environmental situations like the city of Atlanta, running out of water, or firestorms in California, or hurricanes along the coast, an iceless Rideau Canal in Ottawa, and so on, hasn't penetrated into the daily lives and decisions of Canadian governments, anywhere at any level. In my city, the last 10 years, each winter has been warmer than the last. Last year, we didn't have a freeze-up until January 15th. When I was a boy, the snow came at the end of November and stayed till April. When I left home 3 days ago, there's still no ice in the canal. We live in a time which demands new thinking, nonpartisan approaches to governing our cities, and the interest of all. And we have the reverse. We have never had such deeply divided federal parliament, never such deeply divided city councils. I often think it's like being a city councillor on Easter Island when the response to environmental catastrophe was to build more giant heads to appease the gods and make life miserable who were making life miserable for Easter Islanders. We're not building giant heads, but we might as well be. When the Prime Minister of the country can say to citizens across the nation that cities aren't his department, and 80% of Canadians live in cities, you have to wonder who he is governing for. And I don't want to make this partisan. I see it on every side. I said to Jack Layton, who I worked hard as a city councillor, and to Elizabeth May, I said, guys, why don't you get your acts together and present yourself as a common party for the next election with two objectives, a green agenda and getting some democratic reform so we can govern this country right. Well, let me tell you, they thought this was a pretty unpalatable suggestion. I said, you don't have to make it a permanent marriage. Just call it cohabitation for a season. You know? Anyway, Canada has a constitution written in the age of the horse and buggy, 1867. I'm not exaggerating. That's what it is. And in those days, in 1867, the only thing new on the horizon was a steam engine, which came into a few places. In this world, the federal government paid attention to national services like harbors, rails, silo, grain, handling, fishing, and so on. Cities weren't that important. Canadian mayors and city councillors were an honorific position conferred on a businessman who had a successful business and also served the community well in volunteer roles. He was expected to cut ribbons, turn up at community events, sign contracts with municipal workers, and be the convenient butt for good-natured humor. It's a political tradition with absolutely no experience with dealing with the kinds of measures needed to confront global climate change.
You are listening to a speech by urban affairs specialist and longtime Ottawa City Councillor Clive Doucette. This followed the launch of his book, Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual, by New Society Publishers.
The federal government receives 50% of the nation's tax revenues. 50%. The province receives 42% of the tax revenues and has complete legislative control over cities. City politicians are presumed to be janitors, expected to keep the city clean and leave other governments alone to solve the important problems. In Ontario, the provincial government uses this extraordinary legislative power to force Ontario municipalities to contribute 30% of their property tax back to the province for provincial social programs. So not only is your ceremonial mayor totally out of his or her depth in terms of how the city has evolved in the last 30 years, he or she is actively being sabotaged by the so-called senior levels of government to serve partisan politics that make no sense except to play the partisan game of who gets to be the chief. We know how to create sustainable cities. The basics of the recipe are dead simple. There are three ingredients. Stop building roads and widening them now, everywhere. At the same time, go back to building streetcar systems for cities and fast intercity rail for the nation. Create a green roof, low-energy building code for all new building construction and housing refits. That's the second. The third is make sure all fresh water stays within the watershed. Do not let it run off or be exported, and create 100-kilometer laws for food. That means laws forbidding animals to be moved for more than 100 kilometers for slaughter. This is literally the meat and potatoes of creating sustainable cities everywhere. It won't be perfect, but when you consider transportation creates 40% of greenhouse gases, housing creates the other 40%, and agriculture production most of the other 20%. There it is. One, two, three. You've got cities that are sustainable. And we did it before. I grew up in a sustainable city. I grew up in a city that had dairies and bakeries in the heart of it, that trucked in most of its food or from the edge of the city, that had a streetcar system that was built locally, was powered by green power from the Chaudière Falls, and more people rode that cranky old system in 1950 per capita than do today with $1 billion in buses. But it's very clear that the governance system we have is the problem. It's not capable of responding to such clear directives. You see it everywhere at local government, and I will mention just one. Under the guise of more rigorous public health regulations, we now have new laws making it impossible for animals to be slaughtered locally from Nova Scotia to Salt Spring Island. How can you relocalize the agricultural economy with these kinds of laws? The irony is we've got hundreds of wonderful non-governmental organizations working away at creating a more sustainable planet. There are all kinds of heroes and heroines out there, and we hear about them, which is good, but they remind me of the opening scenes of Catch-22. When the hero, Yosaran, is putting a tourniquet on the bleeding leg of his buddy, he's patching him up, and Yosaran is doing a great job. He's got the tourniquet on just like he was taught, and he puts the big bandage on. But his buddy keeps getting paler and paler, and he almost starts to get mad at him, like, come on, you know, you're okay. We're almost at the landing strip. But his buddy just gets grayer and grayer. And then he notices behind, a piece of shrapnel has gone through the back of his jacket and tore a hole in his intestines. And he doesn't have any guts left. This is the image that I have when I read about Robert Redford and Leonardo DiCaprio working hard on the environmental case. They are applying tourniquets, saving forests and land conservancy efforts. But the environmental body is being eviscerated by a political and economic system which is busy subsidizing and coddling the activities which are creating the carbon loading of the atmosphere, where our collective rights to clean air and clean water are dying. Human beings are clan animals. We operate best at the tribal level, and that's the way our governments operate. Our political parties are clan organizations. They serve the clan that elects them. The trouble is with the environment, it's not a clan problem. The environment belongs to no clan. There's no Chinese air, no American air, no Canadian air. And because the environment has no clan connection to human governance, the Earth's atmosphere, the Earth's oceans have become unregulated planetary sewers for every city, corporation, and government on the planet. Human beings are not dumb. In the end, they always tend to do the right thing, especially as it relates to their own survival. Eventually, the medieval walls came down, and people learned to live in a more harmonious way without killing each other if the person was saying the Mass in the wrong language. Humanity can reduce the climate change threat to manageable proportions. The problem is that humanity has never faced this kind of challenge before. Climate change is universal, non-analog threat to the existence of all. This is entirely new, and we, the people of this city and every other city, don't have the public institutions, the traditions, or the political cultures to respond to such a threat. To this moment, the human response has been what any other species would do in similar circumstances. Humans are reverting to what has protected them in the past. And in the past, humans have protected themselves by securing their borders, by increasing their determination to aggressively attack anything that looks remotely dangerous, and this is what we're doing today. The basics of humanity's instinctive reaction to climate change is not as different from lemmings headed for the precipice as you would think. Canadians are spending record amounts on the military. Never before have we spent so much since the Second War. Internal security and all border forces. None of these protective initiatives will increase the number of refuge cities or reduce the number of refugee cities. The good news is, and there's some good news, there's always good news. The good news is old-fashioned Canadian values are exactly what we need. If you ask my father why he fought in the Second War, he would mention democracy in the vote, sure. But it was also his ideas about fairness, about inclusiveness, that no one should go hungry, and that everyone should have a reasonable shelter. That's the kind of village he grew up in, and that's the kind of nation he expected to live in. My daughter would probably express her values in terms of health care. When she took her six-month-old to the hospital in Ottawa, and he received the vital care that he needed to go on, she was one very happy young mother, and she said to me, "Dad, I saw someone drive up to the hospital in a Mercedes, and I saw a woman come to the hospital carrying her baby on the bus, and they both received the same careful treatment." She observed how important this was, both for the babies and for the mothers, but for all of society, because this kind of shared, equal treatment that connects us in ways that unite, not divides. These are the same values that my grandfather had, and they're just fine. There's also good news that it is entirely within our power to create sustainable cities. The physical landscape and the institutional landscape determine everything that happens in cities. And if there's one thing I would like you to take away tonight, I would like you to take that thought away. Change the physical landscape, and you will change your city, and you will change the planet. Stop building roads, start building electric light rail, and we will reduce the carbon loading of the atmosphere significantly by both the tonnage of raw emissions, and we will start the process of retreating from consumer values and moving back to civic values. And when this happens, city governments will change, and so will the national. It's that simple. It's not complicated. We need to build cities from St. John's, Newfoundland to Victoria around electric light rail instead of arterial road systems. As we're doing this, we need to turn our attention to bringing our democracy into the 21st century. Right now, we have 80% of the population receiving 8% of the taxes. That has to change. We can't run our city sustainably when unsustainable growth advantages the powerful governments that benefit from it and disadvantages the weak governments, the municipalities who are paying for it. As a municipality grows, it gets poorer. And my citizens can never understand, "Clive, we're growing, we're rich, we've got all sorts of corporations, and the services are declining." Well, they are, because growth is not paying for itself. The tax share between governments should be 30-30-30, not 50-42-8%. The other part of the institutional landscape that needs fixing is the electoral system. We need to change the electoral system to one that will elect parliaments based on how people actually vote, not on how the vote splits between parties. At the international level, there's no government capable of responding to humanity's collective rights to clean air and water. It should be the UN, but in its present form, it isn't capable of functioning as anything more than a worldwide welfare agency. We need to change this. Don't let the size of the job dishearten you. The democratic framework with which people govern themselves has constantly changed since the time of the Greeks. There is nothing written in the sky that says the federal government must receive 50% of our taxes. There is nothing written in the sky that says the United Nations cannot be empowered to be an environmental policeman. Why should one nation or one city be allowed to diminish the quality of air which every human being requires for existence? Pretty simple. That's a crime, and it should be prosecuted. We can change the world, but we need to start looking beyond celebrity philanthropy. We need to do what the Easter Islanders could not do. Look at how we live and organize society, not complain about the gods. Real change is never easy. Basing city electric around electric light rail runs counter to more than 50 years of urban sprawl. And changing the institutions which govern us runs counter to 150 years of political habits. I'll conclude with one little example of how we have become prisoners of the times we have lived in. A month or two ago, I went to Carleton University and I gave a little lecture to a group of Canadian study students. And I arrived a little early, and the young woman at the front was taking notes on the board about the things she wanted to do to make the university and the city a more environmentally responsible place. And they brainstormed, they came up with about 15 things. And one of them stuck in mind was lug a mug. You know, apparently you're doing that, and it's a good idea. You bring a mug for your coffee instead of getting a styrofoam coffee cup. And I said to the students, this is great. And afterwards I thought about it, and I thought to myself, there wasn't one public concern there. Not one. And believe you me, there was a ton they could have got upset about, and which meant a whole lot. The city of Ottawa, 2 weeks prior to this lecture I was giving, had just approved a 28-kilometer freshwater pipe out to a place called Russell Township. I don't know how far 28 kilometers takes you in Vancouver, but that's right outside our city, so that Russell Township farmers can continue farming with pesticides and herbicides and polluting their groundwater so they can't get clean groundwater, and so that they can grow sprawl. And city council voted for it, and there were only a couple of councillors who opposed, because we said this is an environmental issue. This is the folks in Russell Township should learn how to run their township with the water they have, not pipe it in from an adjacent area. They didn't even know this had happened. And another thing had happened, we closed down, we had a pilot light rail run right through the university, right through the center of it. And it's my ward. I know it intimately. I helped put it in. It got beat up and thrown out by an argument between Liberals and Tories. And we now have a $257 million lawsuit. The city's transit plans are in complete disarray. That was the greenest project the city had ever invented. It was going to go from the extreme south of the city, Barrhaven, right down to the center of the city. It's huge. It was going to take 26,000 tons of carbon out of the air annually. And we had signed the agreement off with Siemens. We won national procurement awards for it. We'd won sustainability awards for the FCM for the pilot. We'd done everything right, and we got clobbered by the present minister of the environment, Mr. Baird, on it. And there wasn't one protest from the university. Not from the students, not from the administration. They just said, oh, well, I guess we'll just have to get a bigger parking lot, which they proceeded to do. So I think it's interesting that we're in such a grip of this individualism and individual approaches. I think we have to find a way to get people excited about the most important thing in creating a sustainable environment, and that's our governments. Our governments are the key. That's not to say they're great. I'm the first one to say they're not. But it's even worse to be cynical about them, because then you're totally disempowered. So I'm through, and I would like to conclude with a small reading from my book, and because it sums up why I've always been a happy warrior. I don't regret a day that I didn't fight against expressways, a day that I didn't fight for streetcars. It's been a wonderful time, and I hope to continue on for many years to come. And I know there's lots of young people to return after me who will continue the fight. And I think this is the reason I do it. For me, the doorstep of my soul doesn't end at my fingertips. For me, the human soul is not a singular Benedictine flight to heaven, nor is the poetry of existence a solitary affair, but connected like a string of DNA to the community, to the city, to the country, and to the planet. And when these connections are broken or damaged, my own soul is diminished and the poetry of existence reduced for all. For me, the mundane struggles against school closures, for better public transit, for wider, safer sidewalks, are all part of something grander. It is part of the struggle for my own soul and the poetry of existence that can be found sitting on my uncle's Cape Breton stoop, watching the sun sink behind Shetika Island. It can equally be found in the ordinary battles of a citizen for a better city and a safer planet. This is what makes life grand and wonderful: sunsets, friends, and purpose, informed not by the accumulation of material things, but by the moments of pure poetry anchored in a life directed towards creating richer possibilities for all. It is what gives life meaning, because for me, the divine is rooted in the integrity of creation, and all those who struggle for that state of mind and state of place which connect us to this ultimate mystery of creation and existence.
You've just heard a speech by Ottawa City Councillor Clive Doucette, author of Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual, by New Society Publishers. Now we'll go to a few of his responses to questions from the audience.
Well, I think you need democratic reform, and that's a real tough sell, because people will work for the homeless, they'll work to save the whales, they'll work for a transit line, but say, look, you know, you've got to change the way you're electing and how you're electing your officials, because that affects everything. That's a much tougher sell. But, I mean, don't you find it a little strange that we have a government that one out of three Canadians voted for, that killed national daycare system, that got us in a war, that has no national transit policy, that has no national housing? We're the only G8 country that have none of those things. So I'm saying the if you want a magic solution, is don't go after affordable housing, don't go after a national transit strategy, go after the electoral system which creates the injustice. Well, I think the reconditioning has to start with putting in streetcars right away is expensive, because it's the tracks that cost. The operating costs are cheap. The reason the GM and all those companies got rid of the streetcars is they actually were the only form of public transit that's ever been invented to compete with a car. Because once you get it up and running, a streetcar will run for 80 years, literally. It's almost unbreakable. And it's powered by a very simple machine, powered by electricity. So people love it, and they use it. So the operating costs over the long haul are fractional. The initial costs are expensive because the tracks are expensive. So I would say do the same thing as the mayor of Bogota does. Put in where you can bus lanes with buses on, and then fill in as fast as you can behind it. And let those folks know out in the big box malls, tax the parking lots. Try and tax the parking lots. I mean, in my town, we tax the bejesus out of all of the old city. You can't park anywhere, the $3 an hour. We've done calculations. One big box mall will return in a year for half usage about $8 million. It's $13 million we take from every city street. So just give you an idea of some of the enormous inequities that are, because the costs of serving those big box parking lots, I mean, the cost are exactly the same as parking on a street. Because those parking slots in a big box mall, all those cars have to get there, and they have to leave there, and they get there and they leave there on city streets. That parking lot is worth nothing without the city investments. So whether you store the car on a city street as a parking or in a mall parking lot, the cost to the city, you the taxpayer, remains exactly the same. So I think find some way to do that. And also I think you've got to find... You've got to find alliances. Those people who shop in the malls, they have children. They get asthma. The number one reason we admit children to hospital in my town now is asthma. The growth is phenomenal, and it's all related to air quality. So make some alliances that way. It's hard. It's hard. We're trying to overcome 60 years of doing it wrong.
Well,
well, I don't know what's going to happen. I only know it's going to be very difficult. I mean, think about it. Have any of you checked how much you're paying for your insurance, for your house and your car? How much money you're paying for? How many thousands? Most people now, their insurance bills are now approaching their municipal tax bills. And when it tips over, I think what's going to happen is people are going to start abandoning their insurance. And once they abandon their insurance, if their house, and this is happening throughout Florida, people cannot afford to insure their homes in Florida. And what's going to happen in Florida, I think you're going to see not too distant future is there's going to be an exodus. People are going to start leaving Florida because they're not going to be able to live there unless you're willing to live basically in the way you did in the old days, which is in a place without any protection in case of a hurricane or whatever. Well, you see it everywhere. You see it in where you're living. I see it in my grandfather's village. The only thing left in Cape Breton in the sea are crab and lobster. And once they're gone, there's going to be nothing. And those are the two pillars which hold up, you know, many, many villages and thousands of people's lives. And the urban meltdown you're talking about here, I'm talking about here, is a meltdown of an unsustainable form of life. And that's impacted the rural areas just the way you say. And you can see it, you know, more vividly. Part of the reason I became an urban activist was that I saw what rural sustainability was on my grandfather's farm, and I saw what urban sustainability was when I lived in a poor part of Ottawa. And I saw, you know, we had, when I was a little kid on the farm, we grew just about and everything we needed to eat, and or we took it from the sea. I mean, now in Grande-Terre, Chitika, you go to the co-op store and you get your oranges from Florida, just like everybody else. And the day that umbilical cord and those trucks stop rolling into the village, people are going to go hungry. So it's all connected. You're absolutely right. What's happening in the cities is impacting the countryside in the same violent, ugly ways.
You've been listening to Ottawa City Councillor Clive Doucette, author of Urban Meltdown, Cities, Climate Change, and Politics as Usual, by New Society Publishers. These answers to audience questions followed his speech January 24, 2008, in Vancouver, Canada. The talk was organized by the Vancouver Public Library and the Necessary Voices Society. Find more of their great speeches and the upcoming program from necessaryvoices.org. The speech was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, originating from CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver. You can download it free of charge from our website at www.ecoshock.org. Look for Cities in our Audio On Demand menu. Well, thanks so much for listening.